universes. And when we put together all these different theories of attachment, developmental immaturity, post-traumatic stress, and internal family systems, they make up a body of knowledge that allows us to run a virus scan on ourselves and at any point to look at our behaviors, our thoughts, and our feelings and figure out where they come from. That's the easy part. The tough part is to quarantine the virus and to recognize the false self and restore the true self. Because it isn't until we start developing an honest, compassionate, and functional relationship with ourselves that we can begin to experience a healthy, loving relationship with others. It's a lot to take in, I think, my head spinning, as the rain concludes. And that is what chair work is all about. Chapter 27. At the Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous meeting that night, Carrie plops down on the sofa next to me, her bare arm resting gently against mine. I move my arm away. This is the new me. "I can't believe that bitch still won't let you talk to me," she says. "It's for your own safety," I respond. "I'm too dangerous for women." Charles, who's sitting across from me, makes a slashing motion over his neck. He's right. Even that little is too much. I leave the room, return a few moments later, and sit somewhere else. Although it seems like a sensible thing to do, and respectful of Ingrid, this kind of distant, uninterested behavior is probably only going to make Carrie like me more. That is, until she hears my check-in. I broke my contract Sunday morning, I confess when my turn comes. I feel weird saying this in front of everyone, but I masturbated. I just woke up in a certain condition and couldn't help myself. The words ring in my head. I couldn't help myself. That sounds exactly like something an addict would say. To reassure myself, I ask if anyone else has masturbated. There's total silence, and then one hand sheepishly rises. "I have," Calvin whispers. Suddenly, I'm the most out-of-control sex addict in the room. Calvin was probably masturbating about his picnic. "I realized afterward," I continue, "that I was masturbating because I was terrified of my girlfriend coming to visit. However, it turned out to be incredible having her here, and it made me want to take my recovery more seriously and become a better person." As we walk out of the lounge after the meeting, Charles falls into step with me. "Let me give you some advice, so you don't break your contract again," he says. "Believe, behave, become. Believe in you and Ingrid. Behave for Ingrid. Become a nuclear family." It's good advice. The three steps. If you ever decide to admit you're powerless over your addiction, you can look me up in LA when you leave, he continues magnanimously. "I can get you into a private therapy group with one of the best CSATs in LA. Evidently, I said the right thing in today's meeting. I decide to ask him how he relapsed, since he shared the details of his story with the group before I arrived. "I was in New Zealand, where prostitution is legal," he answers. His voice is melancholy, yet despite himself, a guilty smile creeps across his face. Joan calls this euphoric recall. "And I ended up going to this place where they had a menu of services, and I had a threesome with two very attractive women for $450. We stand silently at the edge of the dormitory for a moment, both dialing up the visual, a crack of desire appearing in Charles's austerity. "And that was bad," I say, "very bad." "Yeah," he replies, "very bad." That night, I dream that Ingrid and I are in a hotel room in Las Vegas with a priest we're paying by the hour. "I now pronounce you man and wife," the priest says. As soon as the words leave his lips, a cold shroud of fear envelops me. Something irreversible has taken place in just seconds, and I'm overcome with regret because I know I can't reciprocate what Ingrid feels. I wake up with a sense of doom hanging over my head. Charles's words ring in my head. Become a nuclear family. What's so great about a nuclear family? I wonder before I can stop myself. All the word nuclear makes me feel is a fear of annihilation. Chapter 28. Chicago, 23 years earlier. Hello?
Is Todd there?
It's a girl calling for my younger brother. They always call for him. Never for me. No, he's out.
This is Rachel.
Hey.
I'm with Julia, and we were calling to invite him over. We're having a special party. Julia, why don't you tell him about it?
They both giggle. It's a sound only teenage girls can make. It is their mating call.
Yeah, Jonas and Craig were over, but they can't get it up anymore.
What do you mean? What are you guys doing?
We're really horny. Want to come over?
This is it. Finally, a chance to lose my virginity. And I need to become a man before college. There's only one problem. I can't. I'm grounded.
We'll make it worth your while.
How?
We'll give you a blowjob.
Together?
If you want. We'll do you so right if you do us right.
God, I want to come over so much. I can't believe they're offering to have a threesome with me. This would be the Super Bowl of teenage sexual experiences. But I stayed out too late one night without calling my mom. So I got grounded for 2 months. I've spent most of my teenage life punished. The year before, my mom somehow found out that I'd gone to a rock concert I wasn't allowed to attend, so she grounded me for 6 months.
Harry, Julia wants to have sex with you.
Really?
She wants you, Neil.
Fuck. I want her too, but I don't think I can today. Or any day for the next 7 weeks.
Why not?
I told you, I'm grounded.
Just sneak out.
I can't. I don't have the keys to the house.
You're no fun.
Wait.
Let's call Alex. Hey, do you have Alex's number?
Looking back on that phone call, the only time I ever got propositioned in high school or college, I don't know why I never rebelled. Why I never just went out anyway. Why even at that age, I put up with being constantly imprisoned. Senior year of high school, second semester, when you've already been accepted to college. That's supposed to be the best time of your life. At least for teenagers who aren't enmeshed. Chapter 29. Lorraine tapes several sheets of butcher paper across the wall and asks me about my relatives as far back as my great-grandfather. As I speak, she maps my family tree, diagramming everything I know about each relative, from their birth order to tragedies in their lives to the power balance in their marriages. This is called a genogram. She's looking for patterns, and she finds several. I've been doing this a long time. And this is one of the most narcissistic mothers I've ever come across, she tells me when we get to my parents and my relationship history. She's suffocated you, so you set up a wall with her that you kept in place through anger and sneaking around behind her back. And you're still using that wall to keep from being suffocated by Ingrid. Everything she says lands in my head like the sweep of a broom, knocking away cobwebs and uncovering lost brain cells, like the years of anger and regret I harbored over being grounded and missing out on my only high school sexual opportunity. There's one thing that's been bothering me, I tell Lorraine. I can't understand why I never stood up for myself against her strictness and just rebelled or ran away. She looks at my genogram for a moment, then responds, because your example was your dad, and he never stood up for himself, and his father didn't stand up to his mother either. The rest of the guys nod in agreement, as I wonder whether my grandfather had a secret sex life too. Probably. And you'll notice, she continues, that they didn't model a healthy relationship for you. It's no wonder you have fear when it comes to Ingrid. You don't want to end up in a relationship like the one your parents have. Growing up, I often wished my parents would have affairs. When my mother and I found photos of my father out with a woman we didn't recognize, I was happy he'd apparently found some romance and excitement outside his desolate marriage. It's no wonder cheating came so naturally to me. I'd given myself permission long before I'd ever had a girlfriend. Lorraine spends the rest of the morning and most of the afternoon doing everyone's genograms. When she finishes, she tells us that before we start our chair work tomorrow, she wants to teach us about the relationship between the love addict and the love avoidant, or as she prefers to put it, the codependent and the counterdependent. If you think of intimacy as into me I see, and I share that with you, that's intimacy, Lorraine begins. I've heard the word intimacy constantly here, spoken as if it's the holy grail, and all these fun things, from sex, to drugs, to ambition, to even dressing attractively, reading novels, or having intellectual thoughts, are supposed to be eliminated because they're barriers to it. Intimacy problems come from a lack of self-love, she continues. Someone who fears intimacy thinks, unconsciously, if you knew who I actually was, you'd leave me. I always think that, Calvin says, raising his hand for a high five. It goes unslapped. I'd classify all of you as intimacy avoidance, she presses on. The avoidant is very good at seducing, in the sense that he has an uncanny ability to find out what his partner needs and give it to her. Because he was usually enmeshed, he gets his worth and value from taking care of needy people. So are guys love avoidance and women love addicts? Calvin asks. No, Lorraine replies. I've seen both. What happens in either case is that we choose partners who are at our age of emotional development and maturity and whose issues are complementary to ours. Your wives may think they sent you here because you're sick and they're normal, but I've never worked with a couple where one of them had it all together and the other was a screw-up. They've got just as many issues as you do. Proof of this is the fact that they're still with you. Can I please get you on the phone with my wife to tell her that? Adam asks. This is exactly what I'm talking about, Lorraine responds. That's the enmeshed child in you speaking. You should be in recovery for you, not for her. And that's typical of your marriage as a whole. Because when a love avoidant and a love addict begin a relationship, a predictable pattern occurs. The avoidant gives and gives, sacrificing his own needs. But it's never enough for the love addict. So the avoidant grows resentful and seeks an outlet outside of the relationship, but at the same time feels too guilty to stop taking care of the needy person. By outlet, you mean an affair? Adam interrupts. It can be, Lorraine says, but it can also be obsessive exercising, or work, or drugs, or living on the edge, or anything high risk. He will also compartmentalize it, because the secrecy helps kick that intensity up a notch. In the meantime, as the avoidance walls keep getting higher, the love addict uses denial to hold on to the fantasy and starts accepting unacceptable behavior. As she speaks, I think of one of the most classic myths of our civilization, the Odyssey. Odysseus cheats rampantly on his voyage home from the Trojan War, even shacking up with a nymph for 7 years, knowing full well that his wife, Penelope, is waiting for him. Meanwhile, Penelope stays pure for 20 years, even though she thinks he's dead. Yet Odysseus is the hero of the tale and even slaughters all 108 of Penelope's suitors for daring to court her. In here, they diagnose Odysseus as a love avoidant, off adventuring, warring, and intensity seeking, and Penelope as a love addict, living in fantasy. This relationship is as old as time. But the avoidance behavior has consequences, Lorraine continues, and chief among them is something most of you are familiar with, getting caught. And that shatters the fantasy for the love addict, who experiences her biggest nightmare, abandonment, which replicates her original wound. One thing Odysseus did right is that he didn't get caught. That's because they didn't have paparazzi, social media, mobile phones, and the internet back then. It was easier to compartmentalize. The pain and fear are so intense for the love addict, Lorraine continues, that she often develops her own secret life as well. Where the avoidant wants the highs, the addict typically goes for the lows. She wants benzodiazepines, alcohol, romance novels, shopping till she drops, or anything that depresses the central nervous system. If she acts out sexually or has an emotional affair, it's not for intensity, but to numb the pain and get away from the agonizing hurt. Soon, the relationship is no longer about love for either partner, but about escaping from reality. Is everybody one or the other? Calvin asks. I feel like I'm both. It's a good question. I've always seen myself as more ambivalent in my relationships than avoidant. But perhaps doubt is just another form of avoidance, because it prevents me from ever fully committing to anyone. Some people have elements of both, or play different roles at different times, Lorraine responds. She then draws a picture of a healthy relationship. A healthy relationship, she continues, is when two individuated adults decide to have a relationship, and that becomes a third entity. They nurture the relationship, and the relationship nurtures them. But they're not overly dependent or independent. They are interdependent, which means that they take care of the majority of their needs and wants on their own. But when they can't, they're not afraid to ask their partner for help. She pauses to let it all sink in, then concludes, only when our love for someone exceeds our need for them do we have a shot at a genuine relationship together. Can I ask a question? I blurt. For some reason, whenever someone starts telling me what's right and wrong, or making life sound so black and white, I get uneasy. My fellow red demons give one another a look. They know where this usually leads. In her model of an unhealthy relationship, I erase everything but the love avoidant and the word intensity. If we eliminate one person in the dysfunctional relationship, the dysfunction is gone, I explain. What's left is a single guy enjoying life and its pleasures. Why is the option with two people in an interdependent relationship any better than this option? If it's not outside your value system and there aren't any negative consequences, then live it up, Lorraine replies. But I would question why you'd choose intensity over intimacy. Because intensity's more fun, I reply. This time, I return Calvin's high five as I take my seat. I'm not doing a very good job of taking my recovery more seriously, but in her depiction of a relationship, all the highs and peak experiences of life have to be sacrificed in the name of intimacy, and that doesn't seem like a goal worth aspiring to. I'd be willing to bet, Lorraine responds coolly, that after the high of the intensity, there's a come down, and you feel not so great, and you need that next hit of intensity. So ultimately, you can live your life like a hamster on a wheel, chasing after the next hit to keep yourself spinning, or you can realize that ultimately, it's all a distraction to avoid the harsh reality that you are not connected to yourself. The jubilation in the room dies down. Her blows are well aimed and hard. Unlike Joan, Lorraine doesn't seem to be trying to win, but rather to help. And her position is not only less dogmatic, it actually makes sense. There's an unconscious part of ourselves we want to defend, she continues. And it's been useful and helped us survive the difficult stuff we went through with mom or dad or the priest or the coach. but we don't want it driving the car anymore. She looks at me and Troy and Adam and Calvin, then concludes, "Life's not worth living if you're living someone else's life." Calvin starts crying. Chapter 30. Today, I saw myself, for perhaps the first time in my life. The day after Lorraine's lecture, we walk into the treatment room to find 6 chairs carefully arranged. There are 2 chairs near one wall. The first is for Lorraine, the second is for her first victim, which I soon find out is me. There's a 3rd empty chair facing mine on the other side of the room. The seats for the rest of my libidinous brethren are lined up against the wall on my left side, as if out of the range of fire. Each chair has a box of Kleenex next to it. "You're going to want to imagine that you have wetsuits on," Lorraine tells the rest of the guys, "and zip them up tight, because it's going to get very emotional in here, and I don't want any of you affected." I brace myself for what's to come, as she tells me, "Before we start this process, I'd like you to know that there are married men who are not only faithful, but don't even think of cheating." Before the adapted adolescent in me can respond with something cynical, like, "And there are also men born with 11 toes," she tells me to close my eyes and shut off my thoughts. "Pay attention to the feeling of your feet on the ground and the gentle in and out of your breathing," she says, her voice slowing and softening. "Notice how every time you exhale, you become more relaxed." I know what she's doing. She's putting me into a trance, and I trust her. So I try to relax and let go. She asks me to imagine my 8-year-old self sitting next to me, watching the events that are about to unfold. As I try to visualize that skinny, awkward kid with the cheap glasses, I recall Joan saying that fantasizing is a defense against intimacy. So I wonder what she'd have to say about this. Shit, I need to stop thinking critically for this to work. Focus on breathing. Come back to the moment. There. "I want you to imagine that your dad is outside the door," Lorraine says. "Picture him as he looked when you were growing up." I summon an image of my father. He is bald, wearing a faded blue monogram dress shirt, tucked into black slacks. There's a gentleness to his face, but also a distant look, as if he's not completely present. In short, I see him exactly as he was when I was 8. "Call him into the room," Lorraine says, "and ask him to sit down in the chair across from you." I do what she says, and try to imagine my father walking into the room. It's eerie how easy it is to feel like I can see him. The imagination is a powerful thing. Of course, I've had plenty of practice with it, but it usually involves that threesome I missed out on. "What's he doing?" she asks. "He's just sitting there, kind of disconnected." "I'd like you to talk to him. Repeat what I say. Today, I am calling you into this room and holding you accountable for the way you raised me." She speaks the words loudly and forcefully, as if she is the parent and my father the child, as if she is the judge and he the accused. I try to match her tone, repeat her words, and not sound too ridiculous in front of my fellow addicts in their imaginary wetsuits. "This is not about you, Dad," she says. "This is about me." I repeat her words. "This is about your behaviors, not about who you are as a person." I repeat, and she urges me, "Louder, really speak up and tell him off." She shifts into her accusatory voice. "You were never there for me, Dad. When Mom punished me, you chose to stay silent, even though you knew her punishments were arbitrary and unfair." I try to own each phrase, to feel it as deeply as I can, to release it as explosively as possible. And it goes on. "You never protected me. You neglected me. I'm not going to act out for you anymore, Dad. I'm not going to medicate anymore by seducing women." I throw the words with force at my dad, but as I do, a voice in my head goes, "Wait a minute, I worked hard to learn how to seduce women." She's still feeding me. I'm not going to medicate anymore with cheap sex in some club bathroom. I repeat, but the voice in my head grows louder. Hey, those are among my most treasured life experiences. What is she implanting in me while I'm in a trance? Then another voice reminds me, go with it. That's why you're here. So many voices. Joan can add dissociative identity disorder to my file now. And the tirade continues. I'm angry. Shout it, she says. I'm angry. I try, but it's not enough for her. She has me scream it over and over until I'm really summoning wrath and hurling it at him. Tell your father what it was like being punished by him. I do as she instructs. The only time you ever punished me was when you spanked me because I made you late to watch a TV show. I was only a kid, and I was having fun on the walk home. You didn't punish me to make me a better person. It proved everything Mom said about you being selfish. That was wrong, Dad, she has me repeat. My eyes well with tears, with the sadness that I never allowed myself to show at the time. She's getting to me. You were shameless, and I give you back your shame. As I tell him off for not being a father, for being checked out, for never standing up for me, I hear Calvin sobbing in the background. Evidently, he didn't zip his wetsuit up high enough. As for me, I have no wetsuit. I'm in the moment, yelling at my father, flushing out the loneliness and sadness of childhood. It's as if a heavy load is lifting off me. You had a secret life, Dad, I'm telling him now. You lied to all of us, and it wasn't fair. You disappeared on Thursdays, and no one knew where you were or what you were doing. You traded photos with a group of guys who shared your obsession. You kept it in the closet, and it was more important to you than any of us. Let go, Lorraine encourages me. Tell him how shameless it was for him to teach you to lie and sneak and hide things. The next word doesn't make it out of my throat. All that emerges is a sudden, uncontrollable sobbing. I can't remember the last time I cried this much. What just happened? She asks. I realized why he has that obsession, I say, each word escaping after a heave of my chest. Because that's how he feels inside, like a cripple. He's emotionally crippled. And then I really break down. When I recover, she tells me to return his problems, behaviors, emotions, and neglect to him so that I can shrink my shame core. She asks how he's receiving all this, and when I respond that he's taken it in as best he can, she has me tell him to leave the room. Now, she says, I'd like you to imagine your mother standing outside the door. Anxiety bursts from my chest and buzzes through every nerve in my body like a swarm of insects. This is the moment I've been dreading. Chapter 31. It's much more difficult to imagine my mother outside, because just a few days ago, she refused to come here. So I know she'd never walk into a room full of strangers to air personal problems. Order her in then, Lorraine instructs. Tell her she has no choice. I do as she says, and eventually I see my mom limp into the room. What's she doing? Lorraine asks. She's sitting down, and she has a sort of joyful, happy face on. But it's just a mask. Can we see through it? Lorraine asks. It's pretty convincing. Let's see how it holds up. Tell her she told you things she shouldn't tell a kid. I do as she instructs, but for some reason, it doesn't sound very assertive. You made me your surrogate spouse, Lorraine cues me. I repeat her words and try to match her tone, but it rings hollow. You enmeshed me, Mom. I can't seem to find the inner strength and conviction to yell at her about all this. Besides, she doesn't know what enmeshment means. I didn't even know myself until a week ago. You committed emotional incest, Lorraine cues me. This is where I draw the line. I can't say incest. Can I call it emotional abuse? That's fine, she replies. But is anything else wrong? Yeah. As I'm saying these things, I'm hearing her voice in my head, telling me, I did my best to raise you, and I talked to you because I had no one else to turn to. Are those things true? Lorraine asks. They are to her. Are they to you? No. Then tell her what it was like growing up with her, Lorraine continues. If it's easier for you, simply list the things she did. I suck in air and prepare myself. Ever since I presented my timeline, the thread holding together the first 18 years of my life has been completely ripped apart, with strands swirling through my memory, trying to coalesce around the new narrative that Joan and Lorraine see so clearly. So I just let it all out. The room and the world seem to freeze as I vomit out every single memory of being over-controlled, overwhelmed, and overshared with. The constant groundings, the warnings that everyone was out to hurt me, the criticisms of all my friends and girlfriends, the belittling of my dad as a husband and lover, the prohibiting of my first dates, the withholding of keys to the house, the insistence that I report to her room after returning home at night to tell her everything I did, the abandonment when I chose to live with a girlfriend, the request to not bring girlfriends when I visited home, the refusal to let them stay at the house when I did, the comments that she'd rather live to see my next book than to see a grandchild, the constant admonishments that I don't take care of things and I lose everything and I can't be trusted, and on and on and fucking on. I pause. There's more, but that seems like enough for now. Tell her what you think of all that, Lorraine says. The narrative is disturbingly clear. I didn't want to believe the counselors here at first, Mom, because it's so weird. But you've been trying to keep me all to yourself. And since you can't do it physically anymore, you continue to do it emotionally. Why? Do you want to know why? Lorraine asks. Please. She wants a monogamous relationship with you. So when you're in a relationship with someone else, you're being unfaithful to her. And if you don't take your emotional life back, you'll be in a relationship with your mother until the day you die. She has me yell at her, shame on you, Mom, for scaring away women so you could have me to yourself. Despite all I've learned, I still feel guilty for hurting my mom this way and for bursting her bubble. But Lorraine keeps encouraging me to defeat my resistance with volume until I'm roaring her words. This is your pain I've been carrying, Mom. I'm giving your pain back to you. My voice fills the room until it feels like there's no space for air. I'm very angry, and I have a right to be angry. Tell her how it felt when she told you never to make anyone as miserable as your father makes her, Lorraine instructs. It fucked me up, Mom. It made me avoid relationships and made me fear the future. It made me scared that I would make someone I loved miserable, that I was bad for them, that we'd end up hating each other like you and Dad. And all of a sudden, I collapse into tears. Fuck. What are you feeling? Lorraine asks. I haven't been connecting with Ingrid. The tears come harder. I can't believe I'm bawling like this. Again. Every time I have sex with her, I'm thinking about some random woman I didn't have sex with. I'm not letting her in. I'm crumpled in my seat now. I can hear Calvin and the other guys crying. I feel the support and encouragement of all the sex maniacs in the room. It's not fair to her. Do you know why that is? No. Because your mother has taught you to fear women, so you avoid intimacy by not being present and connected when you're with Ingrid. Before I can process that concept, she has me yelling, I'm not letting you scare me away from women anymore, Mom. I'm going to love who I want, and you can find someone else to be your confidant. It's preposterous that I really feel like my mom's sitting there, and I'm telling her all these things. Tears pour down my face. Until this moment, I'd maintained a small reserve of skepticism about the concept of emotional incest. But now there's no doubt. I feel the truth of it in every cell of my body. I'm not going to be afraid of intimacy for you anymore, Mom. And when it seems like everything's come out, that there are no more tears and snot left inside, Lorraine asks if I have anything else to tell my mother. Yes. I take a deep breath and let the last thing out. I'm not keeping your secrets for you anymore, Mom. And fuck if I don't break down again. Lorraine asks what I'm experiencing. I tell her. I realize that she feels on the outside how Dad feels on the inside. Like she's deformed. And then I have a fucking breakdown within the breakdown. I don't share this next epiphany, but I recognize that they do belong together. Two trauma-bonded cripples who are comfortable in their walls of secrecy and silent suffering, who are even more afraid of intimacy than I am, and who are mortally terrified of anyone knowing who they are. It turns out it wasn't me who was the black sheep. That blackness came from them. That's how they feel on the inside, underneath the mask. I thought that the tears were done and dried, but they're back again. This time, though, they're accompanied by a feeling of lightness and freedom in my chest. I can't remember the last time I saw the truth. This is more cathartic than any drug experience I've ever had. All my anxiety and fear and guilt have peeled away as if they were layers of clothing I didn't know I was wearing. I thought they were part of my skin the whole time, but it turns out they were someone else's hand-me-downs. So that's what they mean by my false self. I used to think that intelligence came from books and knowledge and rational thought, but that's not intelligence. It's just information and interpretation. Real intelligence is when your mind and your heart connect. That's when you see the truth so clearly and unmistakably that you don't have to think about it. In fact, all thinking will do is lead you away from the truth, and soon you'll be back in your head, groping with a penlight in the dark again. How's your mother feeling right now? Lorraine asks. It got through to her, I respond. Her walls are crumbling, and she's realizing she wasn't actually a good mother after all. Somehow, I feel set free by the thought that I was heard and understood. To the brain, the difference between reality and imagination can be minor. After all, the information travels down similar neural pathways. So I suppose it doesn't matter that she actually didn't hear a thing and may never understand. My brain thinks she did, and that's good enough. Lorraine directs me to send my mother out of the room, then has me tell my 8-year-old self, who's been sitting next to me and watching the whole time, that I'm firing his parents, and that from now on, I'm taking care of him. She guides me through a visualization in which I imagine shrinking him until he can fit in the palm of my hand and placing him in my heart. Now that you've reparented your inner child, Lorraine instructs, you're going to protect him and look after him and let him play with Ingrid's inner child. She gives me a few moments to imagine this, then gently says, you can open your eyes when you're ready. There's one thing I've been striving for all my life, with sex, with writing, with surfing, with partying, with anything and everything. And that is to be free. It's the one feeling I never had growing up. When I open my eyes, I feel free like I never have before. I see the guys sitting against the wall, their cheeks shining with tears, and I can tell they've been on this ride with me. Then I see Lorraine, beaming at me like an angel, and I tell her, you're doing God's work. The words come out of my mouth before I have a chance to think about them. I've never used the word God in my life in a spiritual context. In fact, the week before, I even had an hour-long debate with the spiritual counselor here, trying to dissuade him from the belief that there's a higher power who cares about the fate of every individual. I once wanted to write a novel called The Big Book of Negativity. It would be about what life is really like, the cold, hard truth. But in this moment, I'm so full of light, hope, and positivity that I wouldn't be able to put a single word on paper. I can't even connect to the idea anymore. I need to hold on to the golden cord that right now is connecting my brain to my heart and illuminating the path to my authentic self. Or, as the singer and poet Patti Smith once put it, the clean human being that I was as a child. You look like you're floating on a foot of air, Calvin tells me. Technically, this process is called post-induction therapy. Others call it ego state integration. Joan calls it feeling reduction work, and Lorraine calls it inexperiential. But those are euphemisms for what it really is. An exorcism. An exorcism of childhood demons. You've been letting the grounded teenager control your life, Lorraine says as I rise unsteadily to my feet, and he wants to compensate for missing out on his adolescence by doing all the things and having all the women he was never allowed. But it's time to be an adult. She hands me a box of Kleenex. It will wear you out if you don't live your authentic life. I excuse myself from the room to get some fresh air. As I stand outside, experiencing the warmth of the sun and the cool of the wind and the smell of the trees through reopened senses, I think, I can't wait to connect with Ingrid, to look into her eyes and let her see into me all the way and not be afraid of what she might find there.
Door 2. Exclusivity. Stage 1. Love avoidant. Enters or returns to relationship out of obligation, connecting behind a wall of seduction. Love addict. Enters or returns to relationship to end pain of abandonment, connecting in a fog of fantasy.
Chapter 1. The problem with time is that it doesn't go backward. Every word, every step, every action is irreversible. If we step in front of a moving car, if we sign a contract we haven't read, if we betray the person we love, the best we can do is try to clean up the mess. But no matter how hard we scrub, the stain on reality will never come out. The word you just heard can never be unheard. And so I am back in the airport where I stood 15 days earlier, on the way to the plane that will take me back to Ingrid, blinking in the light of a reality that is no longer the same. Instead of glimpsing anonymous individuals hurrying by, I see different archetypal products of bad parenting. That meek old man with the blank stare was probably beaten senseless by his father. The sad-looking obese guy in an undersized t-shirt may have grown up with a mom who expressed love only through her cooking. The uptight businessman was likely raised by strict parents who never allowed him to be imperfect. Suddenly, there seemed to be very few adults in the world, just suffering children and overcompensating adolescents. When I see a tempting mane of blonde or black hair, I try not to turn my head and pornify this human being or see her as a collection of body parts. If the discharge papers in my luggage are to be believed, I am a very sick man. According to my psychiatric evaluation, I have Access 1 sexual disorder, generalized anxiety syndrome, and depressive disorder, in addition to problems with primary support group and problems related to social environment. As the coup de grace, I have an Access 5 rating of 50 out of 100, a score reserved for head cases who are either suicidal or so functionally impaired they're unable to form basic friendships. This diagnosis is followed by a 3-page list of medications and treatments I'd supposedly been given in rehab, including an enema, none of which I'd taken or even requested. I wonder for a moment if my mother was right. These medical opinions, most of them made up by someone who clearly has her own psychological issues, are now on my permanent record, where they could come back to haunt me at any time. I start to imagine going through a divorce trial in the future, and a lawyer showing this evaluation to the judge as evidence that I shouldn't have custody of my children. I have left rehab AMA, against medical advice. There was no reason to stay. After the chair work with Lorraine, we were back with Joan for family week. Since my parents weren't coming, and Joan said it wasn't necessary for Ingrid to return, and even Charles admitted that the final week mostly involved administrators trying to upsell the hospital's aftercare program, there didn't seem to be much point in spending the money to stick around. The other guys who didn't have families to save, Calvin and Paul, said they were planning to break out early as well. Before leaving, I stopped by Lorraine's office to get her contact information in case I needed to get in touch with her in an emergency. She gave me an hour of good advice on re-entry into my relationship, explaining, most importantly, that in order to be emotionally free to commit to Ingrid, I need to limit contact with my mother. Stick to news, sports, and weather, she advised with a smile. Then I said goodbye to Joan, whose only words as she closed my file were a dismissive good luck. As I board the plane, I'm excited to use what I've learned about myself to heal my relationship with Ingrid and earn back her trust. However, as I'm buckling my seatbelt, I see body parts. A pair of tan legs, long and toned, topped by tight cut-off denim shorts. I look up to see a frayed, loose-fitting gray sweater that, despite its bagginess, reveals the outline of what are clearly large breasts. The body part above them has flowing brown hair and a golden-hued face with very little makeup. The sum effect of all these parts is so naturally sexual that even a clown suit couldn't hide it. I try to put myself back in the chair with Lorraine and imagine my inner child playing with Ingrid's, but it's too late. Out here, there's just too much reality. Lights, colors, screens, signs, faces, fast food wrappers, yoga pants. My brain is working so hard just to keep up, it doesn't have time to pause and think about consequences. And now, this woman has gotten in. I'm already imagining making out with her and putting my hand up her sweater. This is covert sexualized violence. I need to stop myself. And so I think. Bright red apple, wrong orchard. And I look away. Damn you, Charles. That was actually decent advice. I notice another side effect of rehab. I am no longer attracted to or turned on by random women. Instead, I am triggered by them. It's the same thing, but being attracted is a natural human impulse. Being triggered is an unhealthy plunge into the addiction cycle, into compulsive behavior, into the charts and diagrams hanging in Joan's office. This may be the first step in my downward spiral, and I haven't even been free for 3 hours. Chapter 2. In the baggage claim of LAX, I see her. She's wearing an outfit that would have gotten her banned from rehab. Tank top with no bra and tight jeans, with a wave of blonde hair falling over the left side of her face. At first, she backs away a step, maybe out of shyness, maybe fear. Then joy washes over her face as if a spotlight's been turned on overhead, and she rushes toward me. "I'm ready to start something new with you," she whispers. The warmth of her breath fills my ear, carrying with it the implicit expectation that I've been cured. "Me too," I reply, "and I hope, for both our sakes, that I have changed." We drive along the Pacific Coast Highway, listening to electronic dance music and making up lyrics to each instrumental. The sun kaleidoscopes off the ocean, which stretches endlessly to the left, the silhouette of Catalina Island visible faintly in the distance, like the promise of something new and transitory. Our destination, the two-bedroom guesthouse in Malibu that we used to share. The day she found out I was cheating, Ingrid called two friends to help her move out, and she's been living with them since. Before leaving, her friends grabbed a permanent black marker and effaced not just the books I'd published, but cover samples for ones that weren't even out yet. "I got you something special," Ingrid says with a wide, toothy smile as we walk inside. She pulls a small brass key out of her purse. Everyone deserves a second chance. What's that? I ask. Your mom wouldn't give you the keys to her house when you were in rehab, so I'm giving you my key. To what? To my filing cabinet at work. Why not your house? I have to be out soon because my friend's lease is ending. She takes a small metal chain, threads it through the key, and gently fastens it around my neck like a charm for healing childhood wounds. No one I've dated has ever done anything this meaningful for me. This key, I tell her, will serve as a reminder that I can be trusted and that I can tell the truth. In bed that night, as I hold Ingrid against me and run my hands along her skin, I try to let go completely, to breathe and stay in the moment, to be open and vulnerable. Should we? She asks. I don't know. It's up to you. I don't want you to break your contract, she says. Well, are we really not going to do it for 10 more weeks? I can try to wait. At this point, we're naked, and our bodies aren't listening to us. As I enter her, a rush of chemicals floods my brain and bathes my body. It feels so relieving and uplifting, like I'm high, an alcoholic having his first shot after rehab. But unlike before, I find it easier to stay with Ingrid, remain connected, and look into her eyes and her being, to make love and not just have sex. It's been a long time since I've seen and felt Ingrid this powerfully, and so my love is fleeting. As soon as I release, my body dissolves into weightless euphoria. I'm not sure if sex is an addiction or if it's just awesome. When we shower together afterward, Ingrid starts making out with me. She rubs me against her clit, which I believe would qualify, in Joan's words, as masturbating using my body. However, I'm not hard enough to have sex with her again. I still haven't come, she pouts, trying to put it in. It's only fair that she also get off. So I look at her body and try to pornify her. When this doesn't work, and I see Ingrid's growing distress, I decide to resort to more extreme measures. I think about the woman from the airplane. I'm doing this for Ingrid, I tell myself. And I imagine Short Shorts sitting next to me on the plane, putting an airline blanket over us so she can guide my hands to her smooth tan legs, whispering to meet in the bathroom. It's starting to work. I think about walking into the lavatory and seeing her waiting for me, sitting on the toilet with her sweater off and the button of her cutoff shorts undone, the fly unzipped just enough to reveal her panties. She slides a hand under the waistband and starts touching herself while looking me in the eye. And God, now I'm hard enough. Now I can fuck Ingrid. I'm doing this for her. For her. Chapter 3. In the morning, I retrieve my phone from its resting place in my sock drawer. I insert the battery, wait for it to come to life, and punch in the password. A long parade of texts and emails rolls across the screen. An Asian American tech entrepreneur, whom my friend Melanie once tried to set me up with, writes that she wants to get on Skype to distract me. An Australian girl I hooked up with on a book tour says she wants to end 6 months of celibacy with me. A porn star I once had horrible sex with in a bathroom says she misses me. A social networking friend from France, whom I've never met, asks when I'm going to be in Paris next, and attaches a photo of herself standing naked in a garden. And on, women sending sonar signals, waiting for a ping back so they know what their position is. The women you've slept with, the ones you never did but primed for a future encounter, the ones who seemed interested but then suddenly stopped texting. Unless you do something horribly wrong, they never completely disappear. A lonely night, a cheating boyfriend, a sudden breakup, an attack of low self-esteem, an attack of high self-esteem. Anything can, out of the blue, send them scrolling through their address book, looking for validation, for security, for conversation, for adoration, for the fantasy of you filling some empty space in their life. exacerbating this problem. I included my email address on a whim in one of my early books, mostly because I didn't think anyone would read it. And so new temptation arrives to the inbox almost daily. The one that stops me in my tracks today is from a woman named Radney, who says she'd love to meet me. Unfortunately for my sobriety, she's attached a photo. She is of an ethnicity best described as Las Vegas, artificially constructed to make every cell in the male visual brain throb with desire, a blend of who knows what nationalities, beauty regimens, and surgeries, resulting in a perpetual tan and fake breasts that catch the light like brass Christmas ornaments. I look at Ingrid's key, and it looks back at me. They say that a man is as faithful as his options, and in this moment, I know it to be true. So I switch the phone off. It's too much. Even Jesus only had 3 temptations.
Stage 2. Love avoidant. Feels oppressed by partner's neediness and moves from wall of seduction to wall of resentment. Love addict. Ignores partner's walls and partner's need to have a life beyond the relationship.
Chapter 4. Pets are the gateway drug to children. As a general rule, when a woman over 25 gets a dog, it means she's ready to start a family. Nearly 3 weeks after my return, Ingrid and I are at the West Valley Animal Shelter, where a diseased ball of black and white fur is balancing on its hind legs and ever so gently resting its front paws on Ingrid's kneecap. This one is good. He knows just how to win her heart. It doesn't matter that he's got only one working eye, infected brown goo dripping out of both ears, and a stench worse than a homeless person on a New York subway. The deal is soon closed. This 10-pound runt, bred to be faithful to whoever feeds him, has been saved. Usually, the pound keeps adopted dogs so they can get neutered before being transferred to their new owner. But the receptionist just gives us this one. She's that eager to get rid of him. He has so many health problems, she suggests getting everything else fixed before neutering him. On the way home, I check my post office box. Inside, amid the bills and junk, is a square envelope addressed to me. I recognize the girly handwriting on it as my mom's. I'm shocked when I open it to find a card that reads, "Get your shit together." Then I read the message she's written inside, "And start calling your long-suffering, who loves you mother every week!" ! Until recently, I used to think it was just her sense of humor when she called herself long-suffering. Now I see that every joke comes with a first-class ticket to a guilt trip. Clearly, she's not happy that I abandoned my Sunday phone call obligations after rehab. It's been a while since I've spoken to her, so when we return home, I dutifully pick up the phone and dial her number. The conversation starts casually enough, but soon, the part that Lorraine warned me about begins. "I'm worried about the things they told you in rehab," she says. Her voice is upbeat, as if about to break into song. "People come out of psychotherapy thinking they have problems they don't." She seems to be mounting a defense against whatever I've been learning, like a publicist trying to spin control a scandal. "It's actually been very helpful," I respond, "and I'm smart enough to separate the good from the bad." I wish she were receptive enough to discuss what I learned, but you can't expect the same person who wounded you to heal you. So I take a tip from my last conversation with Lorraine and suggest, let's talk about something else. "One thing first," she says, "I want you to know that your father wasn't involved in your childhood. Marg, the babysitter, and I raised you. I was home all the time for you unless I had to go out for something." Her voice is warm and suffocating, coming at me in a torrent of words I can't stop. My hands and wrists tighten, as if telling me that I need to fight to save myself. News, sports, weather. People always say how nice and sweet your father is, she continues. I think, if only you knew that he's just a piece of dirt. He does not have the ability to love or care. It's an act. I was on his computer the other day, and I saw that he was searching for congenital leg deformity. He's terrible. How's the weather been in Chicago? I ask. It feels like I'm struggling to get a plastic bag off my head before I asphyxiate. You and your brother are the best things that have ever happened to me, she continues, talking right over the question as if she never heard it. I wasted my life is what I really did. So if everything is for nothing, then at least I have the two of you. I need to end this conversation. She may think she's telling me how much she loves me, but what I'm hearing is that by not calling her on Sundays, I'm slowly killing her. One of the biggest indicators of enmeshment, according to Lorraine, is when a mother tells her children that she lives only for them. Hey, I gotta jump off the phone now, I tell her. Why? I have a bunch of work to finish before the day ends. And that's more important than your mother? Mom, I have to go, okay? Okay. Her tone has changed. Now it's sad, bruised, on the verge of tears instead of laughter. Is everything all right, Mom? Now I'm not going to be able to get to sleep tonight. You know how I... The guilt is like a carcinogenic gas, seeping through the holes of the phone receiver, down my ear canal, and toward the folds and crevices of my brain. Have to go, nice talking to you, bye. I hang up the phone. That was a close one. I can't let her get back into my mind. I've got enough problems in there as it is. Chapter 5. I join Ingrid on the couch, where she's sitting next to our used and abused new Shih Tzu. I pet him, and he barely reacts outside of blowing snot from his nose, spraying my arm. Eventually, he rises to his feet, stretches out his front legs, takes a few steps, pisses on the couch, walks in a tight, pointless circle so that the urine gets all over his paws, then drops back onto his chin, exhausted from this evidently Herculean effort. As I grab a roll of paper towels to clean up the mess, I suggest calling him Hercules. Ingrid stares rapturously at his black and white face. I love him, she says. I love Hercules. And I think, I can't believe how easy it is for her to fall in love. And then I think, why is that not cheating? And then I think, now she's going to neuter him. For some reason, I'm disturbed hearing the word love roll out of her mouth so quickly and easily, especially when I've been working so hard to be worthy of it. Maybe love isn't so sacred if we can attach it to any furry thing with a heartbeat, bad breath, and no bladder control. She scoops the dog up in her arms and trots to the bedroom to take a nap. Now she's sleeping with him? Is this still monogamy? I grab my computer, find an image of the Mexican flag, and print it. I have a small publishing imprint at HarperCollins and decided recently to contact two anonymous news bloggers in Mexico about writing a book on the drug war there. Because the Mexican cartels have been trying to find out who they are and execute them, however, the journalists want me to verify my identity. So they asked me to email a photo of myself holding a Mexican flag in one hand and a newspaper with today's date in the other. Lorraine would say this is a way to find intensity outside the relationship without cheating. And perhaps she's right. As the flag image prints, I start thinking about our new Shih Tzu, which makes me think of Asia, which makes me think of Asian women, which makes me think of the tech entrepreneur who wanted to Skype me. I decide to search the internet to see how her startup is doing, and I come across a photo of her in a bikini. 5 minutes later, I'm on Pornhub watching videos of Asian women who look like her while stroking myself. I know I shouldn't be doing this. It's clearly compulsive, but it's too late to stop. That's how compulsions work. Besides, I went to rehab for cheating, not for porn, and I'm not breaking any promises to Ingrid. There's nothing wrong with jerking off occasionally. The whole notion that I can only have an orgasm with Ingrid's participation for the rest of my life is ridiculous. I've been home and well-behaved for almost a month. I deserve this. I'm being interdependent. I should send this image to the Mexican journalists. The link underneath one of the clips leads me to an excessively pierced girl with bleached blonde hair who looks like an emo version of Ingrid. Suddenly, I hear Ingrid's sleepy voice summoning me. Babe? I quickly zip up, close my browser, grab my computer, and walk into the bedroom. But some combination of my flushed cheeks, overly innocent expression, and the laptop in my hand gives me away. Were you watching porn? She's not asking judgmentally, but I feel accused. I went to rehab to stop cheating, and so far I've succeeded. I've been working on my wandering eye, and that's been going well. I'm successfully tapering off my lust one sin at a time. And today, these women are my sexual methadone. Were you or weren't you? This is my chance to be honest and intimate. If there's nothing wrong with watching porn, then I shouldn't have any shame in telling Ingrid about it. Yes, I tell her, I was. I thought you were sleeping and I didn't want to wake you. She rolls over, picks up Hercules from the floor, and hugs him against her chest. I think she already loves that thing more than me. And it looks like she's enmeshing him. Did you finish? She asks. No, I didn't. And here it comes, the knife in the gut, spewing hot guilt all over my insides. You make love to those girls more than you make love to me. That is not true. My heart clenches, my breathing gets shallow, and what feels like hot steel rods coalesce lengthwise from my forearm to my wrist. This is the first time, I protest. I've watched that stuff since I've been back. She scoops up Hercules and walks out of the room. And I'm frustrated, because I shouldn't have to defend myself if I want to have an orgasm without her. Sometimes my inner child is going to want to play with himself. A text suddenly arrives on my phone from Belle, the Australian who wants to end her celibacy experiment with me. It's my birthday today, she writes. I wish you were unwrapping me right now. And I text back, I wish I were too. Instantly, I'm filled with remorse. I don't know why I just did that. Is it because I'm feeling smothered by Ingrid? Or is it because I would have felt guilty letting Belle down on her birthday? Or is it because I need more intensity in my life? Whatever the case, it was a stupid thing to do. And if it isn't technically cheating, it's definitely a violation of Ingrid's trust in me, which would make it cheating. Fuck. I can't believe how easy it was to slip up. That moment of blinding clarity during my chair work with Lorraine already feels so far away, like a memory of childhood innocence. And I wonder if it wasn't actually a cure, but another high. As I'm standing in the bedroom with my shame in my hand, Ingrid stomps back in, stares at me for a moment with a hurt expression, and asks, "What's wrong with me? Am I ugly?" "No, you're not. You're beautiful." And she really is beautiful. The emo girl I masturbated to had a body just like hers. "Then why don't you want to sleep with me?" "I do. I was just procrastinating on my work, and I felt like I smelled bad, and I don't know, I didn't want to bother you." "You keep saying different things." "No, I don't. They're all true." I know she needs reassurance. She needs me to pick her up and sweep her off her feet and make mad, passionate, reconnecting love to her. But right now I can't. I feel too guilty. I'm spiraling into my shame core like an oil prospector who struck shit. However, she does have a good point. Why would I rather masturbate to a girl who looks like Ingrid than actually have sex with her in the flesh? Is this intimacy avoidance, or just normal male fantasizing? And that's when I realize why I was oversensitive to Ingrid's affection for Hercules. Why I'm lusting after these women who aren't one-tenth the person Ingrid is. Why I'm jeopardizing my relationship for a single, stupid text. It's an unconscious reaction to my conversation with my mother. I'm punching holes in the vacuum-sealed plastic bag of my relationship so I don't suffocate. The physiological reactions to Ingrid's complaints about me were almost the same ones I had to my mom's complaints about my father. I drop onto the bed and explain this to Ingrid apologetically, along with my fear of being trapped in a marriage like my parents. Slowly, she begins to thaw, eventually sitting on the bed next to me and stroking my head like I'm Hercules, a helpless creature to be pitied. "Your problem is that you worry too much about the future," she says, her voice confident, her eyes wise, her hand tender. "You could die in a car crash, or there could be an earthquake right now and the house could collapse on top of us. There's no guarantee we'll be here tomorrow. So let's just love each other in this moment and appreciate each other in this moment. We can deal with the future when we get there." She proposes taking a trip together when she can get time off work, someplace we can enjoy peace, nature, and each other. "I've always wanted to hike the Inca Trail to Machu Picchu," she suggests. "Then let's do it," I tell her. She smiles, clasps the key hanging around my neck, and utters the most beautiful words she's spoken since before my infidelity ripped our world apart. "I really trust you now. I don't think you'd ever do anything to hurt me." A wave of joy fills my heart, but it crashes instantly on the shore of guilt. I just texted that Australian woman. If Ingrid saw my phone, she'd be devastated. Chapter 6. Malibu, one day later.
You left rehab early.
There wasn't any point in staying longer.